Welcome to this week's 2 Men in the Middle. This is where two guys from the middle of the country get together and talk politics. I'm Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
And this week, looks like we're going to get a new Supreme Court justice.
Yes, big announcement yesterday. Yeah,
it's Tuesday, so the big TV reveal, Bachelorette style announcement happened on Monday.
Come on, what do you expect anything less from the reality show president?
Again, the guy knows how to do it. He knows how to produce. He knows how to create drama, and he just you can tell he loves it. It's just part of his DNA. I think we're also going to talk a little bit about North Korea and that falling apart, and I'll give you a minute to pick yourself off the floor, Brandon, as you realize, oh my God, Trump didn't, you know, in one 40-minute summit accomplish what three or four fat, well, haven't been, had what no president's been able to accomplish for like
Imagine
70
that.
Years.
No Nobel Prize.
Oh, that's true.
Devastating.
But, Mike, I was saying, have you seen those coins with Trump?
Yes.
I mean, we got to get our hands on one of those.
Talk about jumping the shark. Yeah, those will.
Would we build the 2 Men in the Middle studio somewhere? That's going to have a prominent place somewhere. Mike got mad at me because at one time I said, how would you like to be the designer of that coin and say, I need a coin made with the two ugliest men on the planet on it, Donald Trump on one side, Kim Jong-un on the next. And the whole Mueller probe and all of the excitement and everything that's going on, there's been some kind of big developments in that with Cohn and Manafort, and we probably need to circle back to that.
Oh, yeah.
Figure out what's going on with that thing. But let's hit the Supreme Court nominee first. If you're on my side of the fence, the lib side, the world's coming to an end. We've got to rally and burn down the Capitol to make sure this doesn't happen. This is the worst thing that potentially has happened to us in decades, and we've got to get out and fight the Supreme Court nominee with everything we can, knowing there's absolutely nothing we can do to stop this nomination.
Right, and I think there's some overreaction on your side. Now, granted, whoever he would have named, there would be angst, but out of his shortlist, given to him by the Federalist Society, I mean, this is probably the best you could get in terms of qualifications, in terms of experience, in terms of information out there. There's a wealth of decisions and arguments that you can, trace back to him. And, he really was the establishment pick. There were many in Trump's inner circle that were actually arguing against him because of his ties to the Bush administration, served as Solicitor General in the George H.W. Bush administration, served in the George W. Bush administration, D.C. Circuit Court Judge. And this guy also clerked for Anthony Kennedy as well.
I mean, this guy has, to your point, he has a lot. There's a lot of paper on this guy. He's done a lot of decisions. He's dissented a lot from other conservative jurists. I think the Supreme Court had cited his jurisprudence like 12 times during his career, which is a very large number that the Supreme Court got a case in front of them and agreed with him from a lower court. The reality is there's no way this guy is not the next Supreme Court justice.
Right.
I mean, we're reaching for arguments right now that like there's some sort of conspiracy because under Obama, when Obama was president, he wrote a memo or an opinion that the sitting president could not be indicted for a crime, could not be subpoenaed. That sounds like a massive reach. I don't see that argument gaining any traction at all.
Yeah, and you have to remember, and different pundits and analysts are trying to link that argument to, why Trump may have chose him because he really worked, which is a stretch. Well, and it's even more of a stretch to think that Kavanaugh himself, that would, enter into how he would rule in any case involving the Trump administration.
Well, let's first be straight. Trump didn't select anybody. He didn't select Gorsuch.
Right.
He didn't select this guy. He farmed this out to the Heritage Foundation.
How does he make these decisions? We know now it's usually based on the last person he talks to.
Absolutely.
Though. He gets, people are in his ear saying, you need to do this.
Yes.
And then he just will randomly go with whatever advice he gets usually from the last person.
But this is the first time, and I'm sure every president takes advice from their constituency, the conservative or the liberal think tanks that are aligned to their presidency. But this was kind of a brilliant campaign strategy by Trump, knowing that Supreme Court justices was so important to his base that he basically farmed out a list from two very conservative organizations, held that list up and said, here it is, folks. If you want to know what I'm going to do, here's the list of 25 that I'm taking from.
He did, and he did pick the nominee that's the most difficult to oppose, really. I mean, if you look at one of the central issues that polarizes the country, Roe v. Wade, you know, his prior testimony on that is that, you know, it's settled law. He said, you know, and there's already precedent, you know, and so it's going to be hard to pigeonhole him on that in terms of being for overturning it or anti-Roe v. Wade.
Yeah.
Now, he has supported abortion restrictions, you know, on the D.C. circuit. But that isn't the same as overturning Roe v. Wade if a case comes before him.
I think right now we want to paint everything as a complete reversal of Roe v. Wade.
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen. I saw some polling, 63% of Americans want Roe v. Wade to stand. 73% of independents want it to stand. The only justice I've ever heard openly talk about reversing Roe v. Wade is Clarence Thomas.
Yeah.
So I don't, I think that...
Well, and again, I think abortion is a, you know, such a polarizing topic, right?
It is.
But if you really look at it, you have those on each sides in terms of, you know, wanting abortion completely legal, no restrictions, or those who want it completely outlawed. Most Americans are in the middle. You know, they want some type of access, but they want restrictions. You know, there's the most Americans are in that middle ground. You know, they're not on either side of the fringe as these battles are fought. So that's interesting to take note. And so particularly if his comments on that, particularly during the upcoming Senate hearings, come across as in the middle, I mean, that aligns with where most Americans are. Now, his views on presidential power, I think, are very interesting because, again, that's one area where it has been highlighted as something to question him on and oppose. Those comments were made in 2009 in response to his work with Ken Starr against Bill Clinton. So he seems to have had like this road to Damascus moment where he's like, I really regret, you know, what we did and how we did it, and that was the wrong thing to do, and that they clearly, you know, overplayed themselves when it came to Bill Clinton.
But
so a whole different context than
absolutely
what's going on with Trump, which I think is fascinating.
What you just said, you can stretch back all the way to Ken Starr and Clinton with this guy.
Oh, yeah.
He
was one of the attorneys involved in the Elian Gonzalez case going back, and the 2000
recall.
He was
a prosecutor under Starr. He was involved with... Bush and Gore. I mean, I like that they pick somebody who has put 30 years of their career, documented it, and it's all on the table now. I have a fear Democrats are going to overplay this hand.
I think they do. I mean, personally, I like him. He was my pick out of all of the ones that were being, you know, discussed and thrown around. And he's intelligent. He has the experience, the qualifications. And I think he will come across very well in the hearings. He's not going to slip up. He's not going to give them a moment to where they can say, oh, you know, he's not. Yeah.
For a lot of Democrats, myself in this, I hate any pick that's not Merrick Garland. Because again, I go right back to, for me, that's what turned the Supreme Court into a political entity.
Right.
And it also showed the failure of the Democratic Party to stand up. Obama could have named Merrick Garland as a recess appointment and really had a fight. And we chose not to do that. I'll never understand that. Why? From now until the day I die, every Supreme Court nominee, why is it not Merrick Garland? And I think there's a whole bunch of us Democrats, and rightfully so, we're never getting over that. Giving up that ground. That's never going to be something that we don't trot out every time. And that wound's fairly still fresh. It's going to be even worse when Ginsburg finally goes. But I think at this point, we've got to understand where we are. We're not going to overtake the Senate in November. The numbers just simply don't play to our favor. And we're going to have to make a decision. Is putting up a fight that we know we're going to lose, is it going to cost us seats in the Senate in North Dakota, West Virginia? There's a lot of Democrats are going to have to win in a red state. Is this our Waterloo? Are we going to put ourselves even farther back in Senate seats and farther out of position to take over the Senate to fight and argue for a nomination process that's going to succeed?
Right. And the concern is if you go overboard and you make this a rallying cry, I mean, you could ultimately help turn out the far right base as well, who, you know, see this as, you know, a hill to die on. So you got to be
Democrats,
cautious of that.
We're in the mood to go overboard. I mean, the whole time Trump's been here, the whole exercise has been, how do you resist but not over the top, because really it's Midwestern Democrats in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Minnesota. They're the ones that we really kind of have to appeal to. I don't know how kicking off a national campaign to stop this nomination is going to help us in those areas.
No, I mean, there's much better arguments to make to actually win those seats necessary than dying on this hill. That's for sure.
And for Dems too, this is easy. Don't lose the presidential election in 2016. We're not here. Don't lose right. the Senate. We're not here. Put better candidates out. Come up with a better platform.
Better campaign, better strategy. Yeah.
The power in America, if you want political power back, you got to win it back. And I think that's the message that's going to get lost on us, is going to be what we really want to do is have this cathartic moment where we blow off some steam and make a big show and a big fuss over this Supreme Court nominee, and we don't concentrate on winning back.
Right. And the message should be elections have consequences. If you're unhappy, let's get to work. Let's go out and change things.
I was on a Facebook thread this weekend where someone's like, none of this matters. None of this affects me. You know, politics has gotten so it doesn't affect anybody on a day-to-day basis. It's almost like, well, buckle up, because it's just about to.
Oh, it is. And I think that's what gets lost in all this is the lifetime appointment mechanism when it comes to Supreme Court justices. Yeah. When the framers originally designed
this. This is a great point you made.
People didn't live past their 50s. So they had no concept that somebody could serve on the court for 40, 50 years. And so that's the reality we have now. I mean, these are the most powerful people in our country, unchecked, and really lifetime appointments. So no matter what happens or what they do, they cannot be removed unless, you know, they serve out until they pass
away.
What
does it take to remove a Supreme Court justice?
I mean, it's high crimes and misdemeanors. Yeah. It has to be something that rises to the level of that. So they can't be
stab somebody. It's just not going to happen.
Right. They can't be removed for illness. They can't be removed if they, lose their senses or their faculties. Yeah. I mean, it has to be super serious.
So both of us agree that the nomination, the process for nominating Supreme Court justices need to change.
Absolutely.
And
it's no longer
the Senate
viable.
Needs to go back to 60. If there's anything, lifelong appointment, you said, really, you're there as long as you want, and you're really unchecked.
Because these nominees should be vetted as much as possible. And the whole idea, again, going back, the Senate is a deliberative body. That's why you had the 60-vote threshold. They are supposed to think and really, you know, pan this out and consider the consequences on all sides. And you can't do that if you only have a simple majority is needed.
If we're not going to go back to 60, then we need to talk about this becomes a 10-year appointment and maybe there's an election involved.
Right.
So somehow, if we're going to turn the Supreme Court into a political entity, then we need to have a political process.
I really dislike the idea of Supreme Court justices running for election. I think that makes it extremely political. Yeah, and there's a handful of states that elect their state Supreme Court justices,
I
don't think that's a good idea at all. I don't think you want that. Yeah. I mean, you can have basically tenured process where you cap them out at 20 years or 10 years or something like that. I think that's the answer. You don't want to resort to elections.
What if we just did this? Mandatory retirement age of 75.
Could
we live with that?
I think, yeah. I could live with that, yeah.
So, Brandon, I am older than you. I can tell you. Are you approaching 40?
I'm 32. I'm approaching 33
August, yeah. Let me tell you, once you hit 40, it's like falling off a cliff.
Thanks.
Anybody who is in their 40s or 50s will tell you, you're not as mentally sharp as you were the decade before. I love Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I'd like to see her
RBG.
Live till she's 1,000. I get that. But she is 85, and you don't have... It's just the natural aging process. I've been a huge believer that we've got to start enacting some rules around you can't run for president, or you have to be under 65 the day you're inaugurated.
Yes.
I think that's totally
reasonable. We had the two oldest two-party nominees this past election cycle ever in our history of the country. I mean, both, it's just phenomenal.
If you're in the Senate, there has to be a mandatory retirement age. Dianne Feinstein, hey, she's on my team. She's been there a long time. She's 84. Or yeah. She's 84, you're right. Yeah. She could be, we just can't have that. I mean, we've got to start looking at how do you move people out of the way. We talked about in our recent political history, the four people that have really run the legislative branch in our party are McConnell, Ryan, Schumer, Pelosi. That's not a very awe-inspiring list of politicians.
None of them. I don't care which side of the aisle you're on. I mean, I think they all need to be replaced.
Other than Ryan, who's fairly young.
He's fairly young, yeah.
Pelosi, Schumer, McConnell, they've been there for decades. There has to be a process that those people move aside and a new generation takes over for some of that.
Absolutely.
This is going to be interesting to his confirmation process, to watch how much does the Democratic senators personalize this to Trump. That being said, there's this theory that he just picked you because you wrote this decision or this opinion that a president, sitting president, can't be arrested, can't be prosecuted, all of that. How much of this do we take off of this guy and make it about Trump, I think is going to dictate a lot of one, what's the perceptions of Democrats, the Democratic senators and the Democrats that are running? What's the perception of them both in the country and in their local markets that they have to go back and appeal to? And I think you're going to see a lot of people walk a very, very thin line with that.
I think they will. And I think there's an expectation that this is a high-pitched battle. I think the activists on the left, you know, expect them to put up a fight. At the end of the day, whether or not he has the votes, and it looks like he likely will have the votes. But, I mean, he's going to be asked to, you know, attest to his independence from the administration, particularly for cases that may be imminent before the court that we all know about involving the administration. And so I think that's going to be pretty clear. And so his responses will be very interesting. It was notable. I saw a quote the other day that came across. So Kavanaugh said this some time ago, but he said the independence and life tenure of federal judges justifies a more searching inquiry by the Senate into their fitness and qualifications for office. I guarantee you a Democratic senator will bring up that exact quote
Brandon
as they address
down.
Him. I did not remember that. I'm not that good.
I think it's his. This is one of those things that this could get very distasteful very quickly, very fast. And a lot of this is just going to go with how long do Democrats want to hold out for this? One theory is that Mueller will drop something during this that changes the game. I think that's a little, I don't think that's going to happen. If that's what you're waiting on or wishing for, I don't.
Well, and knowing like Mueller's reputation, I mean, he doesn't make political calculations
Mueller doesn't care one iota about the timetable for getting this person confirmed. God, so this is two for Trump. I think he's got at least one more. I mean,
yeah, possibly.
RGB is 85. The other guy is 80.
I mean, assuming he serves out a full four years.
If he gets reelected. Absolutely. He's pulling probably two more, and his legacy as a president is he's going to shape the Supreme Court for 50 years.
Which, think about that. I mean, more so than many past presidents, which is really unbelievable.
This is it again. If you don't think elections count in the age of the court system really has picked up the slack for a non-existent legislative branch, it absolutely counts.
Well, and I think this gets back to the idea, too. We do not, because these justices are waiting so long to retire.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. I mean, if going back to when Obama was president, you know, based on what we see now, it may have been best for Ruth Bader Ginsburg to retire then.
Absolutely.
And, you know, and it would have helped the
Absolutely.
Democrats a whole lot. And instead, we're in this situation now where, you know, they wait until literally almost the very end, and then you're playing Russian roulette because you don't know who's going to be in office and who's going to have the majority.
And you just, like I said, they've given so much power to these people, and they are literally unchecked, and they can wield that power really any way that they want.
Oh, yeah.
To your point, a lifetime appointment used to be about 15 years. I don't think they ever meant this to say you could be sitting there for 40, 45 years.
They didn't conceive of it back then.
They just couldn't conceive of it. I think that... again, not a big fan of the election process, but if we're ever going to do something, I think now is the time to do it. What do you think, too, about the idea that the legislative branch of our government has just been absent the last 10 to 15 years, and they're almost farming out making of law to the court system? And that's why these nominees are so important right now.
Right. I think that's a extremely important point. It's an example of abdication, and it's more on political fear, you know, and, you know, part of that is, especially in the House, they're up every 2 years. So there's this trend of just, you know, postponing any type of achievable legislation to the point where nothing actually does get done, because they're afraid that it's going to harm their impact, if not with their base and with, you know, the independents or the middle that they need. So what results is that we don't have anything getting done. Yeah. And gone are the days where you had leaders reaching across the aisle, working together. You know, it's you know, probably oversaid, but, you know, Reagan and Tip O'Neill getting together to work on legislation, that doesn't happen
and
anymore.
Mitch McConnell said it. He told the entire Senate, we're in the personnel business. That's what we do. Our main job is judges and cabinet members. And we do not take up legislation that the president will not sign.
And really, the Supreme
Court. Horrible.
The Supreme Court is forced to address a lot of this because Congress won't act and create law. So they have to then make decisions based on what existing law there is. And so Congress could address that if they would, I mean, through immigration, several of these where we need reform and we need legislation. It's not happening. The other part of that, too, is that, you know, the Congress has a responsibility as one of the three co-equal branches of government to be a check on the executive. I mean, they are supposed to serve as that check, and that's not happening at all now.
No, not at all. Especially when the senior level of that body basically says, we only take up legislation that we know the executive branch will sign.
Right.
The House is just the most absolutely dysfunctional group there is.
Oh, it is.
We've talked about it. It's so split up. You've got the Tea Party faction. You've got your moderates. You've got your right wing. There's just no way to push anything through
to get
that.
Them all on the same page is impossible. Look at immigration.
Even
That's
if
a
you
prime
can
example.
Push something through it, it's nothing the Senate's ever going to pass.
Right.
So, you know, the House is going to pass. They failed multiple times to pass an immigration bill. They did get something through on Obamacare, knowing that the odds of it getting through the Senate were next to nothing. We've talked about the Hastert rule, where, again, it's the majority of the majority has to agree on something before it even can be voted on. So it disincentivizes everyone to work together to form a coalition between parties. What I'm hoping Democrat rage kind of can get focused on is the institutional problems that our government is having, and maybe start a conversation. And this is playing the long game. How do we modernize some of these things within our government?
Well, I mean, far be it for me to recommend what the Democrats should do, but if they came up with...
You couldn't do any worse than what we've been doing the last 5 years.
But I think it would behoove them to head into this election cycle with some type of platform, with, you know, a series of bullets in terms of what they want to accomplish, but primarily on government reform, institutional reform. How are we going to change the way the game is played? How are we going to change the way legislation is passed? What are we going to do from day one to make government work for people? And point to where it's not working right now. I mean, I think most people can buy into that. You know, government ethics, government reform. I mean, there's this broad consensus that what is DC isn't working right now. Yeah. I mean, focus on that. Create like a, you know, almost like what Newt did with the contract with America, but do it with, you know, government reform and what's not working right now in the House. I mean, you could easily do that.
For our side, we're getting so wrapped up with culture issues. We're getting so wrapped up in, I think, identity politics. We're getting so wrapped up on
that's a mistake. It turns off people in the middle.
Absolutely, it is. Without knowing that, again, the coasts are ours. We don't need to debate that anymore.
You're going to win those no matter what.
For good or bad. And I'm not saying this is the way it should be. And I agree that this should be looked into, be changed. But it's about five states, and it's going to come down to those five states now, over and over and over again. To your point, if you're not dealing with the dinner room table topics that are important to upper Midwest Democrats, well, good luck beating Trump in 2020.
Right.
I mean, I hate to say it. I guess I'm feeling more and more negative about my side of the fence. And I'm just kind of gearing myself up mentally for what's going to happen with this Supreme Court nominee. But if we keep continuing missing that opportunity, we're taking somebody that the midterm should be a layup. I mean, you have an unpopular president who owns all three branches. Historically, we should wipe out the House and have a better than 50% chance than take the Senate. I think we'll squeak the House, and I don't think we're going to make any inroads in the Senate at all. If we don't get our feet underneath us in those areas, Trump's not just going to roll over in 2020.
Yeah, well, I think part of the problem is there's no coherent message right now, and there's no messenger carrying that message.
There's no leader.
Right.
Because who would, it can't be
and
someone.
It can't be Schumer. It can't be Pelosi.
The old guard's got to blow out. It can't be like Kamala Harris. I mean, because she's right in that part that she's not going to appeal to the upper Midwest Democrats. She's too far left. She's too California. Right. I'm not saying I disagree with any of her policies. I think she's a phenomenal speaker. She's a great politician. She's definitely somebody that can lead the party, but not now. It's not what we need. Same way with Elizabeth Warren. I love Elizabeth Warren. Love what she's done with after the whole 2008 banks fall apart, the commission she put together and the agency she puts together to protect consumers. I think all of that is relevant. And if you were really looking for a change agent on the Dem side, she could carry that mantle. There's no way she's electable in 2020. I just don't see it because, again,
and that's the problem. Like, I struggle to name names on the Democratic side who just kind of resonate as really solid leaders.
Who connects on the Democratic side? Who could you see at a rally in Ohio draw a large crowd and those people walk away saying, I think that person at least understands a little bit about what I'm about, and yeah, I'd feel comfortable voting for him. I'm struggling right now. I like Cory Booker.
I think he's somebody who's
potential to do that.
And he has more centrist views on many issues.
He does.
And he's younger. So, I mean, he's one. Someone I hear talked about quite often is Kirsten Gillibrand in New York.
Yeah.
There's her. And I'm sure there's others too. I mean, there's still time for somebody to emerge. I mean,
there will.
Let's not forget, Bill Clinton, nobody knew who he was 16 months before the election.
Absolutely.
He was a dark horse.
It's there's still time, but I think it's the Democratic Party. Your party is just taken off. Yeah, I mean, by taken off, I mean, you've just closed your eyes. You've got the hands over your eyes.
Right, in a bad way. Yeah.
Your mouth is shut. You're just like the rational Republicans like you.
Buried into a ditch, yeah.
You're like, we'll just sit and watch this dumpster fire. Yeah. And when the kids are done burning the house down, we'll pick up whatever we have left and we'll move on as we always do. And I think you've kind of come to the conclusion, there's just nothing you can do.
This
is a force of nature. You're not going to persuade anybody. Right now, the Republican Party is a raging dumpster fire that you just have to let burn out.
Absolutely. I'm just watching and waiting. I mean, it's you can say.
But at least you have fire.
Right.
We're just sitting, standing around like, does anybody have any idea what we should be doing? And I think Trump's proven this, that it's almost better to be a dumpster fire because people at least look at the dumpster fire and pay attention to the dumpster fire and are interested in the dumpster fire. I don't even know if we're interesting anymore. I mean, we're just kind of sitting here. Trump has backed us into this corner where all we want to do is crab, complain, fight. And we don't have any type of coherent strategy.
And that's what I don't understand, because I feel like it should be the opposite. I mean, you have like the perfect candidate to run against.
Absolutely.
Trump. I mean, you could have asked for a better gift.
We should wipe you out at the midterms. We should take over the Senate, the House, and effectively end his presidency. I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. I'm with you on that.
As I've told our marketing team at work over and over and over again, because we get, like all businesses, and you're quasi-marketing, right?
Digital marketing, yeah.
And it's something that, when people put out content, we can get very particular, and it gets edited, and it's edited again, and edited again, and somebody else adds something. If Trump's taught us nothing, it's the content has nothing to do with it. It's the frequency in which you say it.
Repetition.
Has everything to do with it. Just keep telling the same lie over and over and over again. Feel no shame about telling the lie. That's what moves the ball forward. We've got to, I don't think that's the new rules of the game going forward, but we've got to figure out a way to kind of pivot our messaging and do some stuff differently. Yeah.
Task ahead.
So I've totally depressed myself now with the Supreme Court justice. I this is not anybody that I'm comfortable with. But again, this is the consequence of losing an election and losing the Senate. These things happen, and you just have to live with them from here on out.
Yeah, and I think it is worth remember that there's only 50 Republicans right now in the Senate with John McCain out being ill. And, you know, 49 Democrats, which means, again,
he's going to get it.
Now, if
there's no way he doesn't,
if Trump would have nominated one of the other nominees on his list, I think it would have been very precarious.
Now,
because you could have had a few Republican votes peel away. But the big issue is the red state Democrats. It's going to be very hard for them to oppose this nominee with his qualifications
absolutely.
And experience.
If you're North Dakota, if you're Virginia, is your state, how do you step in front of them and say, this basically he's a very conservative judge, but his values match what yours are, and I didn't vote for him because Chuck Schumer wanted to make this a battle for Democrats.
Right.
I just don't think that's a message. And in the end, five or six Dems are going to vote for this guy. It just makes sense, and they know it. Schumer knows it. Everybody knows it. It's kind of like, let's just get on with it.
Exactly.
The only gal, the Amy Coney Barrett, if I'm saying her name right, that's the woman who's like very Catholic, and she is very pro-life. And this is what scares me. So Trump has gotten two now. Let's assume Kavanaugh gets through the nomination process, as we all think he will. He's put two kind of acceptable conservatives on. If RGB goes down or somebody else, that I still think it will empower him at some point. If he gets a third or a fourth, he's going totally right. He's going to eventually pick somebody off of that's not on that list. He's going to make a bold move at some point.
Oh, he will. He'll appoint somebody who's Scalia-esque.
Yes.
Definitely.
And if you take RGB off that and you throw Scalia on, we're done. A 45-year-old Scalia, well, good luck, because that's not gonna work.
Right. And if you look at some of the nominees, like you mentioned, like Amy Barrett, I mean, she's young. I think she's in her 40s.
Right? Yeah. And what's interesting is all I've heard this week is your side feels like they've been jobbed by the Supreme Court for the past 30 years. My side feels like we've been jobbed by the Supreme Court for the past 30 years. Isn't that kind of the way it's supposed to be?
Exactly. You want the court is, with that power that it wields, you don't want them to be veering to the extreme all the time on either side. I mean, we're a very diverse country of over 300 million people. I mean, they should wade carefully. So the fact that both sides are upset with the court half the time, I mean, that's a pretty good sign that they're probably trending in the right direction.
Yeah.
And I think that's a fear, though, that if you, again, you mess with that split and that changes suddenly, I mean, we could see some, you know, pretty radical shift in terms of where the country goes. So
were you shocked, Brandon, that the North Korean denuclearization pact deal, blood oath, whatever Trump and Kim Jong-un, Trump said they signed it. I don't know if that's accurate or not. Were you shocked when Pompeo flies over there and they're like, no, we're not denuclearizing anything?
Oh, yeah. Shocked, because, I mean, this is like their history, right? I mean, they've done this time and time again with every single president. And we somehow think, you know, because we're so focused on our, you know, personality cult with Trump, that that's going to change things, you know, because he's going to just like wine and dine the leader and everything's going to be
this
rainbows and
unicorns. American is going to show up, and because I am who I am, everything's different.
But, you know, and I was excoriated on social media because I said from the very beginning, you know, this is, you know, just wait and see. You know, we've been down this road before.
Come on.
And if you look, that paper, was it worth the ink that was used to sign it?
It was a stunt.
Completely.
It was just a show.
I mean, there was nothing tangible that the North Koreans gave. We did, however, we immediately suspended, you know, military maneuvers with the South Koreans and the Japanese, which have really, you know, and without consulting to them, by the way. I think that got missed. I mean, the Japanese and South Koreans were like, what's going on? Like,
all we did is betray our allies to a certain extent. Betray is kind of a harsh word, but we moved unilaterally to do something and didn't consult them, which is not what you're supposed to do with an ally. We praised Kim Jong-un on a national and global
stage.
Gave
him legitimacy. He
didn't
have
him before. Legitimacy.
Downplayed his human rights abuses.
Didn't even talk about his human rights abuses.
Well, yeah.
And then in the end, got nothing, which is what we all kind of assumed was going to happen.
Well, and it's interesting because with the military games, if you remember, Trump actually referred to them as provocative war games, which is the exact terminology the North Koreans use. That is not the terminology the American
Trump
diplomats
use. Trump couldn't come up with the line provocative war games. Somebody wrote that for him or something.
But, you know, it was interesting because he was ceding even in terms of how he referred to him. I mean, he was ceding to the terms that the North Koreans use, how they refer to him. But you know who's most excited about this? China. Because
China
they no longer have the Americans play in their backyard. And if you look at like the South China Sea, the and that entire area, China is becoming more and more aggressive off of the coast of Japan, off of Taiwan. I mean, this gives them even more leverage to get more aggressive.
So here's the analogy that I would use. So, Brendan, I'm having trouble with a third party. And I need, and this is a third party that is very close to you, one of your closest friends. So I come to you and say, can you help me with this other person? I'm having a problem. And you kind of begrudgingly agree. Say, okay, I get it. I understand. I'll help you. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, let's go drive over and we'll talk to this person and get this worked out. And we drive over, and on the way, when we get there, I get out of your car and I just key your car as I walk down the side. And then I'm shocked when you really aren't that helpful. To me, that's China. Because what Trump did is right before we start a situation and a process that we desperately need their help in, we start a trade war with them. Where is the four-dimensional chess of all of this, and how are these tumblers clicking together? I don't know. I'd argue with you there is none. But this is part, again, of Trump. You know, he has these two different ideas of how he can influence and impact the world with his force of personality, and he doesn't connect things together.
He doesn't see how one impacts the other.
You don't piss China off and then ask them to help you control North Korea.
Oh, the timing could not have been worse.
That's just ridiculous.
Well, and I mean, and in the process, I mean, we've pissed off of our trading partners in Europe and in Canada and Mexico as well. So in terms of a unified front, I mean, why would any of our former allies come to our defense?
As we speak, Air Force One has touched down or is in the air to Helsinki for Trump's NATO summit. Any hope that that's not a complete disaster?
Oh, not at all. No, I don't see anything worthwhile that comes from that.
No, not at all.
I mean, we would be lucky as if it turns out to be nothing and there's no headlines that emerge, but you're not going to see anything productive.
Well, then, of course, he scheduled the Putin visit right after that. So if I'm Merkel, if I'm anybody, if I'm Trudeau, Mercone, I'm sitting there saying, I'm not even talking to Trump anymore, because my assumption is anything I say to you is going straight to Putin. You purposely scheduled that visit after this one. You know, at some point, message received. We get it. You don't want to be here. You don't think this is worth your while. You think we're freeloading off of you. Just get to your Russian summit. We'll just be done.
Yeah. Again, I mean, the optics of that. I mean, the fact that there's nobody that was able to persuade him, you know, that, hey, this isn't a good idea to schedule this summit directly after.
Do you think that a president should meet with a foreign leader with nobody else in the room? Do you think that's... I've been thinking about that. They're making a huge deal that Trump is meeting with Putin, and there's going to be some meetings where there's no official note taker. It's just them, translators, and that's it. You know, I really don't think that's that big.
I don't think so. I mean, it's been done before, and I think that, you know, it allows, you know, for, I think in any other context, it would allow for some just kind of one-on-one, very casual, be able to talk without having distractions. I mean, I can see how, you know, there'd be some discomfort considering the context with this president in Russia and everything that's happened. But I don't see that being a big issue overall. I think there's much bigger issues at play that we need to
Trump comes address. Back and says, I talked to Putin. You know what? Crimea was really theirs anyway. We're getting rid of these sanctions. They're not really helping. They're not really hurting. Putin's a good guy. We need to get along. That's it. I'm taking him off. I'm done. What's the Republican Party reaction to that, if any?
Well, I think you would have some that would immediately say, no, that's off the table. I think you would have some that would be muted, you know, because they don't, out of fear, they don't want to say anything. And then you would have a third group that would just acquiesce, that are basically Trump Republicans, and would somehow change their tune and be fine with that, under the guidance of saying, you know, oh, he knows what he's doing. He has some kind of grand plan, which we hear time and time again. You know, we just don't know.
There's something at play.
There's something
here
at play that we don't know. So it would be a cohesive response. It would be very convoluted.
And you just said something there that that's really important, that for most of my life, politics has been about a cohesive response, and the parties were about cohesive responses. There was a person that everybody got behind. There was a pecking order, I guess, in which you said, and you didn't get out of line. The phrase towing the party line, that's what it means.
Right.
Is it social media? Is it just a new generation of politicians? But I kind of really preferred it when there was a person, a party line, and you could generally count on some consistency in how it was
messaged. Well, particularly
with
foreign policy, you need consistency. I think
Absolutely.
The chaos only causes more damage. And ideally, you would have that come from somebody like Paul Ryan as a Speaker of the House. He would stand for the entire Republican caucus.
Yeah.
But again, the caucus is so fragmented that
the Tea Partiers,
he can't speak for all of them.
He can't do it.
It can't happen.
Senate the same way.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about the Mueller probe. And we really haven't gone knees deep into this, because really this is a waiting game. And I get tired of shows that just constantly beat on breaking news on this, or we're going to take an hour and just guess and just kind of inject opinion and wild kind of innuendo into this with no fact base at all. I think all of us just have to wait for this to run its natural course. We talked a little bit about Clinton and Whitewater before we started, and for anybody old enough to remember that investigation went for 6 years.
Very long.
There were some people that went to jail over that. Scooter Libby and some other folks.
Right.
But it yielded very little to nothing for the amount of effort and time it took. I would make the argument that the Mueller probe has already done more as far as identifying criminal activity in the year and a half it's been going than the entire Whitewater thing.
Well, and we've already had
over
a dozen indictments.
We've had a lot.
There's been, and so you can't discount that.
There's people sitting in jail right now because of Mueller, and more to come.
And I think, and you have to realize these things take time. And so, I mean, by historical standards, I mean, this investigation hasn't gone on long at all.
And I do agree that this is politically, especially for Democrats, this is a bit exhausting, because we want this so bad to have
the meat.
We want it. We want him to throw that report down, say Trump's a crook, walk away, and this whole thing ends. And then Mike Pence becomes president, and we just start our cycle of outrage and meltdown once again.
Right.
But it feels like there's been some things that have happened of significance in the last 3 or 4 weeks. You mentioned Michael Cohen has come out and said, I don't think he's come out and said, but he's given every indication, change of lawyers.
Oh, yeah.
He's
sent out strong signals. And this was Trump's fixer, probably the person who was thought to be most loyal to him.
Yeah.
And here he is scrubbing his Twitter account, removing references to being Trump's attorney, saying that he puts family and country before all else.
Yes.
I mean, subtle but very strong signals indicating that, you know, he's changing his tone by all accounts.
When faced with many, many years in prison, everybody flips. That's
right.
The general rule. You can talk tough until the evidence gets in front of you and your lawyer says, you're not getting out of this. You're going to jail. Now it's a matter for how.
Well, and anonymous sources who are friends of Cohen have said that he has come to the realization too that Trump is not going to be loyal to him, which, again, anybody that has worked with Trump knows that, I mean, his loyalty only goes so far.
Well,
I mean,
Michael Cohen knows Trump better than anybody. If if this experience is just teaching him that, that's on him being rather silly. If he didn't think that what was going to happen is Trump would flip on him, distance himself, and do everything he could to bury him, that's kind of on Cohen. I don't think Cohen's stupid, but I don't think he's overly smart either.
Right. Well, I agree. And I think this is really intriguing because, I mean, this is the guy who probably knows the most. He's been around Trump the longest. He's been, you know, tasked with doing the dirtiest of deeds. And so what he divulges to Mueller, I think, you know, assuming he cooperates, I mean, could, you know, provide a lot of ammunition. I mean, out of anybody that we've seen so far.
True. It's as Democrats, we've got to start prepping ourselves for nothing comes out of the Mueller investigation. We have to start realizing that we're probably in the second half to third quarter of this investigation. But at the end of this, it might come out that Trump is a bad guy. His sons are morons. He hung around with basically criminals. But in the end, there's nothing we can pin to him that's going to end his presidency.
Right.
And we've got to start prepping that maybe that is the outcome that comes out of this investigation.
Exactly. That there may have not been direct collusion. They just may have been overly stupid. And, you know, and the.
Or it was Eric or Don Jr. or one of those other idiots that did it.
Detracts
from that
message.
From an evidentiary standpoint, you can't tie it back to Trump. That really might be the most probable conclusion that comes out of this thing. My point is Trump just colludes in plain sight.
Yeah.
I mean, he doesn't really even try to hide it. It gets back to what a difficulty is to prove collusion. I mean, Trump does things that absolutely I think you could tie back to Putin, to Russia, and he just does it in such a way that I guess we just don't even see it anymore.
Oh, yeah, and there's so much there in terms of, like, conflict of interest and business interest. And
we haven't even talked about
that. None of that's been talked about or tapped.
Right. We're just letting all of that go, putting our eggs in this basket.
And that's why I think that's a danger. Unless something big drops before November, I think that the Mueller investigation shouldn't be the centerpiece. It should be all of this other stuff. It should be the corruption
Absolutely.
In government, the conflict
Absolutely.
Of interest.
I've said before, drop everything Russia and just focus on the corruption, and you probably have a much better opportunity. If your agenda is to put heat on Trump to get him out of office early or to defeat him in 2020,
right.
the corruption route is the way to go.
Well, and again, it complements having a platform or a ethics agenda for Congress very well, too, because you focus on the corruption currently, and you say we're going to offer this agenda, this, you know, renewal, whatever you call it, and these are the 5 points, and this is how we're going to institute reform.
Yeah, or as Dems, come up with something better.
Right.
Let it go. Just saying, we're not even going
to. You need to have an alternative. Yeah,
absolutely. Let him bury himself. Stay out of the hole. Stop digging. Stop jumping in every single trap that he lays. Tell Maxine Waters to shut up.
Perfect example of
stop it. Come out and say, we're not voting for Pelosi. We're not going to get Schumer. These are not the people that lead the party, and do something that excites your crowd a little bit.
Right.
I just get the feeling, and Mike is new to Team Dim. He'll kind of learn this lesson the hard way. It's being a Democrat's a lot like being kind of a Missouri Tigers fan. You just get used to disappointment.
Right.
And a lot of times you wait for, we've been dealt the best hand we've been dealt in years in the midterms. How are we going to screw this up? That's the first feeling that comes over you. How are we going to miss the message, not make the message, and squander this opportunity that we've got right now?
Well, it would be especially painful if you guys come up short, but come up so close. I mean, within a couple of seats. I mean,
I think we'll take the House just because the number of
I agree. I still think
that
that's set to happen. If
the
you look
Senate's
at the
a bit out of reach.
Marginal districts, I don't see any way you don't pick those up.
The Senate's going to be tough because, again, Trump with the Supreme Court nominees reminding people why they voted for him. Right. And, you know, this is, and he's played this off very well. This whole idea that the Dems are the party of Pelosi and Schumer were the party of open borders and crime. We just never have quite learned how to punch back to that.
Yeah.
And we've got to find, do we have to find a force of personality like Trump to combat that? Do we combat it with a clear policy? I just don't know. The thing that gives me hope is, again, we've talked, the coalition of women that voted for him cannot hold in 2020.
Yeah.
And we'll see if it cracks in the 2018 midterms.
Yeah, those numbers election night will be very interesting to analyze.
So I listen to a ton of podcasts. So I've admitted several times I'm a Joe Rogan fanboy. Joe Rogan turned me on to Dave Rubin. If you've heard of
Dave Rubin. I've heard of Dave Rubin, yeah.
Dave Rubin is, I don't know how I would describe his political affiliation. He's kind of conservative, kind of libertarian. He is doing some, he's on tour right now with Jordan Peterson. And he was on with Joe Rogan. And they were talking about the wedding cake, the bakery
cakes
for the Supreme Court. So I'm hitting you with this. I didn't tell you this was coming. So I'll give you a little bit to digest
okay.
this. And they were talking about, was that decision right? And depending on how you fall on this, and I have to admit, I generally agree. I don't like forcing people to do things that are against their religious beliefs. Now, I think religious beliefs have gotten twisted around and around the axle multiple times, around Obamacare, around reproductive rights. But in, as a general principle, if you have a legitimate religious objection to something, I don't think the government should force you to do that. But what he said, and I've been thinking about this a lot for the last couple of weeks, is he's like, and Dave Rubin, by the way, is gay. Mm-hmm. And he basically said, hey, I don't like the fact that that guy chose not to make that cake. I respect his religious objection not to do it. And maybe the answer for a gay couple, if you're in Alabama or Mississippi, maybe it's move. Maybe the answer is that you just need to go somewhere where the tolerance and the understanding and the diversity level is such that you don't have to worry about these types of things. And that got me thinking that the United States has always been segmented into different regions, and there's different religious affiliation, political affiliation, right. different cultural norms. That's going to happen in something of a country this big and this diverse. But how many steps away are we from saying, hey, we're just going to segment up into three or four different sections? The Supreme Court is going to return massive amounts of lawmaking and rights interpretations to the states. And as a citizen, you just decide what territory fits you the best, and that's where you go.
Well, and on many issues, I mean, that's the way it should be. I mean, we are, you know, that's a federalist system. I should say, when it comes to policy making, you know, yeah. we're considered a laboratory, right? That's why, you know, Hawaii might try something, you know, that Kansas would not try. But I think you have to be careful. I think you can't legislate tolerance per se, but there are certain rights that come into play that can and must be legislated. And so, again, you get back to that idea of what you define as a right or not. I think that the wedding cake case is very tricky, I think, because, you know, on one hand, there's, yes, a religious, you know, belief that comes into play. But then there's also the idea that you are operating a business and you are, you know, selling a product or engaging in a transaction, and then you're discriminating based on the fact that you do not like the customer or the type of product that
and
they're asking
now
for.
And now baking a cake is art, and somehow that's protected. Those are the concept that you just said.
Yeah.
You don't open a business to the public and then say, well, I'm not going to serve you because I don't like you. And I don't think, again, not everything can be considered art.
No.
I wrote a beautiful email today. That does not mean that I'm an artist.
It's not a work of art?
No, it's not a work of art. But isn't that, I guess what I'm thinking of is that when we started this out and we've talked about, you know, how much the founding fathers could not have projected into the future, that we would be this big, this diverse, this many people, is that just the natural growth process for the United States? That it's illogical, and it's not a sustainable model that we can keep 300 plus million people in a democracy all kind of marching to the same beat, all unified, all working on policy. And the best way to do this is there's either one of two things going to happen. One, we're going to go authoritarian, because if you look at countries with massive populations, most of them historically have had authoritarian populations.
China, Russia.
Yeah, because somebody just comes down and says, we're going to do it. There's no debate. That's how it's going to be. And that's how they get things done. Or we divide up culturally into four or five zones and just kind of go from there.
Well, and we're unique in having representative democracy, having a republic or a government with as large of a population as we have. Yeah, we're not homogenous anymore on any scale. Not like, you know, some of these small European countries where they don't have the same level of unrest and political battles.
We're the largest democracy in America in the world, correct? By population.
By population, yes.
Okay. Yeah. Because China's not a democracy.
Nope, and Russia's
not. She just comes
not.
Up and says, guess what? Ruler for life. India, I'll be honest, I don't know enough about their political system, but I think they're a parliamentary representation.
Parliamentary democracy,
but
yeah.
They've got
British holdover.
They've got some weird stuff. They're not a democracy as we are a democracy. I don't
know. No, and I think when you look at a democracy too, you have to look beyond just free and fair elections. You look at, you know, rights of minorities,
absolutely,
you know, property rights, rule of law, all of those factors come into play. But yeah, I guess the question is, you know, do we survive as we are another, you know, 100, 200 years, or do we fragment?
The countries of the EU, they're state sizes.
Right.
France, England, Spain, other than Russia.
Much easier to manage. Yeah,
they're much they're not pulling this off on the scale that we're trying to pull it off on. And maybe this is just running its course.
Yeah, although, you know, what comes after if that's the case? I mean, maybe we're seeing some of that, you know, there's going to be a issue on the ballot in California this November on whether to break California
into three spots. Maybe it's time to do that. I think the theme I take away from this and something I've got to think about more is modernizing. Since Trump came to office, I think he has pointed out multiple areas that our democracy and our government needs a rethink. It needs a 2018 2.0 relaunch. And maybe it's time for some party or someone to pick that up and make that part of our consciousness and think about that as a country.
And maybe instead of like fragmentation, you know, we change, you know, how we elect, you know, our representatives. Yeah. Instead of like a majoritarian first past the post system, which we have now, you go to proportional representation.
I would love that.
Or you look at what Maine has implemented. I forget the name of theirs, but it's similar to proportional. It's basically where you basically prioritize all the choices on the ballot,
yeah,
and then
California
the choices are knocked off, and those votes
absolutely
are reallocated. And
is
so that's already, again, happening.
Is it time, too, to realize that the United States presidency is too much for one person? I mean, we're electing
one alpha
chimp to lead the entire...
What's the alternative to that? You have to have an executive.
A three-person tribunal make up the executive thing.
Sounds like ancient Rome, the Roman Republic, when they had the consul, the two co-leaders.
One deals with foreign policy. One deals with the economy. One deals with social issues. I'm just saying, I don't want to get rid of the executive branch of our government,
right,
but it follows that theme of maybe it's time to rethink some things.
But ideally, that's why we have a presidential cabinet and we have specialized roles, cabinet roles, that they're supposed to lead in those areas.
I don't know if you know this, but Kellyanne Conway is in the cabinet. So that kind of, you know.
She's an advisor. She's not a cabinet secretary, yeah.
What do you think of Scott Pruitt getting the boot?
Well, finally, right? I mean, how many scandals does it take to, you know, get an EPA head, you know, thrown out of office? How many looks does it take to get to the center of a Tootsie Pop?
You can just look at that guy and say, douche, can't you?
Oh, yeah.
The stories of he sends people out to get a specific lotion he likes. He tried to bully his wife into like a $200,000 job at the Republicans Attorney General Association or something.
Spent massive amount of money on his office and furniture and flying on private planes.
EPA secretary needs a security detail of 19 people?
Yeah,
that's
ridiculous.
Ridiculous. So I'm glad he's gone. I have no expectations of the next EPA.
Yeah.
It's just about slashing policies, burning it all down. And I don't think there's really any
awareness. The next one is an oil industry executive.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I think he won't have the baggage in terms of all the ethical issues that Pruitt had.
So this has been, again, I get into these negative funks looking back. This is about as negative as I've been on
the podcast.
I know,
this is like the most negative podcast we've had so far.
I know. Wow. Because again, you're just looking for something positive. Boy, it's getting harder and harder to find, isn't it?
We're gonna need to like supplement this and have at least like one positive story that we like end with like every single time.
It's like you have to say three things nice about my side. I have to say three things nice, and we force ourselves into it.
That's right.
All right, Brandon. Thanks.
Good. Thanks.